Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
You talking to me?
Neuroscience and the law.
You talking to me?
Can the chemistry of your brain make you do criminal acts?
Then who the hell else are you talking to? Talking to me?
Should the law be changed in response to the findings of neuroscience?
How do the latest findings in neuroscience complicate the criminal justice system?
I can't seem to face up to the facts. I'm tense and nervous and I can't relax. I can't sleep cause my bed's on fire. Don't touch me, I'm a real live wire. Psycho killer, guess you see.
Our guest is David Eagleman, director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action at the Baylor College of Medicine, author of Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain.
Neuroscience and the Law, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
You talking to me?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're broadcasting from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. That's where Ken and I are professors of philosophy when we're not on the radio.
And today, we're philosophizing about neuroscience and the law.
Neuroscience, the study of the brain and how it works, is revolutionizing our understanding of how our mind works. In the process, it's challenging age-old ways of thinking about crime and punishment. Some neuroscientists even say that, in the light of their discoveries, it's time to completely rethink our judicial system.
And that's because both common sense and our current legal system presuppose a certain picture of how the mind works that many neuroscientists now believe is almost entirely wrong, John.
Well, common sense says that a person is morally responsible for a wrongful action only if the action results from their free, conscious, deliberate choice. Pretty much the same idea is expressed in the law with the concept of a guilty mind, or a mens rea. Under the law, an act can't make you guilty unless your mind is guilty, too.
Well, Thomas, let's be precise here. The law actually distinguishes several different levels of criminal culpability. There is strict liability, negligence, recklessness, and even more. A wrongdoer doesn't actually have to make a free, conscious, deliberate choice to be culpable in these other weaker ways, you know.
True enough, show off. But my point still stands, in spite of your erudition. The law differentiates between actions we freely choose and actions that we don't choose. The law holds us most responsible and punishes us most severely for actions of that first kind.
And this is where modern neuroscience comes into the picture, to throw cold water on the idea that we freely choose any of our actions. And neuroscience also teaches us that most of what the brain does to cause behavior actually happens without the benefit of conscious deliberation at all. Conscious deliberation is at best a small, tiny, tiny tip of a huge iceberg.
But look, all the law really needs is a distinction between doing something on purpose, in full awareness of the consequences of action, and doing something out of ignorance or doing something because your brain circuitry is misfiring in ways beyond your control. Think of the difference between you, let's, for the sake of argument, say a relatively normal person with an intact brain, and say a paranoid schizophrenic. Surely neuroscience doesn't show that. As far as the law is concerned, we all might as well be paranoid schizophrenics.
That's true, John. That's true. But neuroscience, what it does do is refuse to draw sharp lines. It sees it all in a continuum. Look, take your supposedly normal law-abiding citizen. Upset their dopamine or serotonin balance just a teeny bit. Or make a tiny lesion in just the right place in the neural circuitry. And presto changeo, you know what you've done? You've turned your upstanding law-abiding citizen into a vicious criminal just like that. Boom.
Are you suggesting that all criminal behavior is the result of bad neural chemistry and circuitry and is, therefore, excusable?
Well, look, all human behavior, every single bit of it, is the result of our neural chemistry and circuitry. That wasn't my point. My point was that relatively small differences in our brain can make huge differences in our behavior. Unfortunately for us, we don't have much direct conscious control over our neural chemistry and circuitry. So we have far less direct conscious control over our behavior than the law imagines. But, you know, I don't think it follows from that alone that we should necessarily excuse criminal behavior.
Well, if you don't want to excuse criminal behavior, what exactly do you want to do about it?
Well, what do we do with other bad outcomes caused by chemical imbalances or bad wiring? We treat them with medication or therapy or surgery. And you know, John, one day soon, we'll be able to do the same when bad chemistry leads to someone to perform criminal actions.
So instead of punishing criminals and sending them to prison, in your brave new world, we should treat them.
Well, I'm not, it is a brave new world, but I'm not ruling out punishment altogether. I mean, punishment provides negative feedback. The brain sometimes changes itself in response to such feedback. But you know what? I bet you that neuroscience can help us learn which forms of punishment provide effective feedback and which don't.
You've drunk the Kool-Aid, Ken. But there's a lot of questions we need to address before I'm even willing to sip from the cup.
But John, but it tastes so good. What's holding you back, my friend?
Well, I think everything you've been saying presupposes a philosophically problematic, I mean, maybe even naive, idea of freedom. What philosophers call contra-causal freedom. That's a kind of absolute and total freedom that our will is supposed to have. So it doesn't depend on the brain, and it just chooses our actions entirely and exclusively by itself. We don't have freedom like that. And maybe, if that's not obvious, neuroscience can help us see that. But neither common sense nor our legal system, in my humble opinion, assumes that we have such contra-causal free will.
So, you know, you're raising a big, complicated philosophical question, John. I don't deny that. And it's one we really, really need to dig into. And to help set the stage for our further explorations, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, to learn more about a dramatic case where a problem in his brain leads one man to commit a terrible crime.
What if I told you a middle-aged man had made sexual advances toward his underage stepdaughter? What would you say?
I think I'd be disgusted.
My initial reaction would be for the concern and safety of the child.
I think that he should be at least treated and probably punished, probably imprisoned. Isn't there a law against that?
There is a law against that. And here's the story of a man we'll call Patient X.
He was an educated man who had performed a number of interesting jobs, including police officer and school teacher.
Russell Swordlow is a neuroscientist at the University of Kansas. Patient X was in his early 40s. He complained of headaches, had suicidal tendencies, balance issues, and he was suffering from a sudden onset of pedophilia. X had no criminal record, no history of pedophilia, but recently he'd been making subtle sexual advances toward his prepubescent stepdaughter. Soon his wife found out and turned up a trove of child pornography. He was convicted of child molestation, prescribed medication, and ordered into a 12-step rehab program for sex addicts. But he was quickly expelled from the program for soliciting sexual favors from other clients and staff.
He described it as basically the brakes were just off his behavior. He knew what he was doing. He knew it was wrong. Yet, he couldn't stop himself.
Swordlow met Patient X the day before he was to begin a prison sentence.
And when we evaluated him, you know, the interaction was unusual and suggested that perhaps there was something neurological. He didn't seem particularly distressed by the fact that he was going to be discharged to the prison. He was kind of jovial. And he was laying there in the bed. He was wearing a pair of sweatpants, and it was clear that he had urinated on himself. He didn't seem particularly concerned about that.
So Swordlow ordered an MRI.
You know, I wasn't surprised to find an abnormality affecting the right frontal lobe, but I was surprised by the size of the lesion that was there. So I would say it was maybe the size of a lemon.
And it was pressing on an area of the right frontal lobe called the orbital frontal cortex.
Damage to the orbital frontal cortex for some time has been recognized to result in and associate with impulsive and antisocial behavior.
Patient X was transferred to a team of neurosurgeons who removed the tumor, and he got better. A judge decided that his tumor may have contributed to his pedophilia and gave him another chance to complete the rehab program, which he did successfully. Patient X avoided jail, and after 7 months, he returned to his wife and stepdaughter. But then, a year later, his problems started again.
He had started hoarding pornography.
The brain tumor was back, this time about the size of a ping pong ball. The second tumor was removed, and this time, the part of his skull where the tumor had grown was radiated so it wouldn't return. Swordlow kept in touch with him for several years and says Patient X was living normally in society.
This was clearly a case where prison wasn't going to fix this man. A neurosurgeon was.
But the question remains, is Patient X still responsible for his pedophilia? Should he be punished?
I think that he should receive some kind of punishment, some sort of treatment, I guess. I mean, how do we know that the lemon-sized tumor really did cause him to sexually abuse his daughter?
Being confined and pulled away from society is not necessarily the kind of action that would change his behavior in the future.
I mean, I feel bad for the guy more than anything else. His actions are bad. His actions are reprehensible, but I don't think he himself is necessarily a bad person.
Dr. Swordlow says the law considers a person's sanity and whether or not he knows the difference between right and wrong.
There's also a group of people that know the difference between right from wrong but can't act on that knowledge. And I guess part of the challenge is where you draw the line between how able or unable do you have to be to act on that knowledge before it becomes a mitigating factor.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks to Caitlin Esch and to Russell Swordlow, her guest, for that truly fascinating case study. I'm John Perry. With me is my colleague in the Stanford Philosophy Department, Ken Taylor.
And we're talking today about neuroscience and the law. We're joined now by David Eagleman. He's the director of the Initiative on Neuroscience and Law from the Baylor College of Medicine. He's author of Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. David, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks. Good to be here.
David, neuroscience is a fascinating area of study in its own right, and so I'm willing to grant is the law. So tell us, what first got you interested in bringing these two fascinating areas together?
When I grew up in New Mexico, my father was a forensic psychiatrist, and he was involved in all of the big mass murder cases in the Southwest. And so from the time I was a child, I was exposed to these very striking aspects of human behavior. And I think the main thing I learned from watching these cases and his assessments was that brains can be very different from one another. And really what I learned was that you can't always put yourself in someone else's shoes, neurally speaking. So, for example, there was a mass murderer and he was being considered for the death penalty. And someone said to my father, but surely he feels regret for what he's done. And my father was sort of surprised by that statement. He said, actually, not at all. He doesn't feel any regret, and this murderer doesn't. And instead, this murderer, when he thinks about going to kill someone, even now, feels the excitement that he felt as a child on the night before Christmas. And so what this means is it's really – brains are very different from one another. And so that was an early lesson for me that I think isn't always intuitive. And when I grew up, I became a neuroscientist, and I study all levels and aspects of the brain, but to me, where neuroscience meets social policy, that's really where the rubber hits the road. That's why I'm interested in that intersection.
Well, let's go back then to the issues that Ken and I were exploring earlier. Ken seemed willing to grant that neuroscience really completely undermines our idea of freedom and with it the legal idea of criminal culpability. I'm willing to grant that neuroscience does undermine some wacko notion of free will that some people have held, but not the kind of freedom that's really relevant to our legal system and criminal culpability. So tell me, which side are you on?
It may be that the question of free will is kind of the wrong question for us to be asking, and I'll tell you why I say that. It's because what's really clear at this point is that the conscious mind, the part that's deliberative and thinks through things with subjective awareness, that's the smallest bit of what's happening in the brain. And the fact is that brains are like fingerprints in that they're all very different from one another. And this is because of a complicated interaction of the genetics you come to the table with and every one of your experiences beginning in your childhood.
So wait a minute, David. So you're on my side, mm-hmm. right? Isn't that what you're saying? That this notion of free will that plays such a large role in common sense, we really don't know what to make of it. It doesn't really seem all that deeply relevant to the real causes of our behavior. Aren't you on my side?
I am on your side. I think that the question of whether or not we have free will is a difficult one to answer. Science may be a little bit too young to really – there is no killer experiment that tells us one way or another. But what I argue in my book Incognito is that the answer to that doesn't matter because, Ken, of I think what you're saying, which is that if free will exists, it is a bit player in the system. It is the smallest bit of what's happening. Most of what drives your decision making, what you believe, how you act, this is all generated by parts of our brain that we have no access to or no acquaintance with.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're talking about neuroscience and the law with David Eagleman, author of Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain.
Coming up next, we're going to dig deeper into the workings of the brain and see what neuroscience has to teach us about the real causes of criminal behavior.
How the criminal mind really works. Plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Certainly, greed is a motive for criminal behavior. But there may also be something else at work. We're talking about neuroscience and the law. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Do criminals always freely and consciously choose their actions? Or can criminal behavior be due to factors in the brain over which we have absolutely no direct control? If so, do criminals deserve to be punished for their crimes? Or is the opposite true? They're entitled to treatment.
Our guest is David Eagleman. He's from the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston.
So, Dave, I want to set you up with a little hypothetical. Suppose I need a lot of money. I need it right away. I think to myself, well, I could go out and get a job and work for it. Or there's that bank over there. I could rob that bank. I think, okay, working is safe, it's legal, but it takes too long, and it's not very thrilling. The quicker but riskier route is bank robbery, and plus it's thrilling. Consciously weighing the rewards and the risks, I decide. I'm going to rob the bank. I know full well that I might get caught, that I might have to kill a security guard or two along the way. Now, I'm going to ask you this question. Is there anything in neuroscience, anything at all, that challenges this common sense picture of how we make plans and decisions?
Well, certainly the idea that it's a deliberative, conscious act is probably incorrect because, in fact, it's everything in your entire life leading you up to that moment that's going to drive that decision. And that last bit of what you feel is conscious deliberation might just be justification or post hoc storytelling anyway.
So let me just interrupt there. There's two things that you're putting together, conscious and deliberation. A lot of people do that. That seems to me not a good idea. I'm willing to grant that consciousness is kind of like the icing on the cake or maybe not even that important, the froth on the beer. The big concept here is what John Fisher calls reason's responsiveness. That is, even if Ken in his bank robbing planning wasn't consciously aware of all the things he needed to do, still, he was responsive to reasons. If you told him that's a bad thing, he could ignore that reason. If you told him that your chances of getting caught are very good, he might not ignore that reason. So can we kind of separate the deliberation and intention and that whole apparatus of common sense and this idea of consciousness, which I don't think is so important?
I think that's right. What Ken has in his head when he goes to rob the bank is some sort of cost-benefit equation with lots of pieces and parts to it. The social cost, the risk he takes, the benefits that he's going to get from it, and which decision he takes tells us something at a crude level about the parameters in his equation, his cost-benefit ratio inside his head. None of that has to be conscious at all, so I agree with that statement.
But then what follows from that? If I've got this cost-benefit statement and calculus inside my head, you know, I value certain things, I don't value other things, I like, I'm a thrill seeker rather than a cautious person, you know, that all adds up to make my decision somehow. I mean, isn't the law justified in saying, well, look, if you made this kind of cost-benefit analysis, then we're going to hold you responsible? Because that seems like neuroscience seems to support, not undermine, that picture of decision-making.
So I agree with that statement. So the first thing I want to emphasize that's really important is that as we have better and better biological understanding of why some people will choose to rob the bank and other people won't, This does not equal exculpation. Biological explanation doesn't let anyone off the hook. It still means that we'll punish, we'll have a penal system, but it changes the way we punish. It gives us the opportunity, as we understand, let's say there are five people in front of us who've all robbed a bank. They might have done it for completely different reasons. One has schizophrenia and was totally disconnected from reality. One is a psychopath who did it because it's a thrill ride and he has no remorse about hurting other people. One did it because his wife is in the hospital and he can't afford the medication and he was desperate, and so on. As we have a better biological understanding of what's happening with people, we can customize our sentencing and our rehabilitation. As it stands now, we treat incarceration as a one-size-fits-all solution. And as I'm sure you guys know, America is the number one country in the world for the percentage of our population that we put behind bars.
By a very wide margin.
We really want you to join this conversation. We want to know what you think. We're talking about neuroscience and the law with David Eagleman from the Baylor College of Medicine. And David, that's a fascinating point you made. It raises a question for me. Suppose that do you envision a day when neuroscience will advance far enough? You know, we can do these health profiles of people. We can say, look, if you're overweight, you got this gene, you've got a certain percentage chance of getting diabetes or whatever. I'm just going to give you this health profile based on all this stuff we know about you. It's not certain, but there's certain probabilities. And if we know that about you, we can say, well, you should exercise more. You should watch your diet. You should do these things. Can we do like a brain scan of people and say, you know, people with brains like you, sometimes they have a certain probability of turning into serial killers. And if you don't want to be a serial killer, you ought to do this and that and not do this and that. Do you ever envision a day when we can do kind of brain profiling for dispositions to criminality?
That won't happen, and I'll tell you why. It's for a few reasons. First of all, somebody's behavior in the world depends so greatly on context. So you take the exact same brain and you drop it into different contexts. This one lives in a violent neighborhood where the best way to survive is to be violent. This one happens to be born into a family where the best way to survive is to go, you know, end up on Wall Street. This one over here becomes a soldier and so on. You take the same brain and put it in different contexts and you have heroes or criminals. So there's no such thing as a criminal brain, really. And when you look at some of the people that we decorate the most and admire the most, if they had been in a different context, their aggression and ruthlessness at doing whatever they were doing would have gotten them into trouble.
But can't we learn about the function, as it were, from brain type to environment to behavioral outcomes? That is to say, I look at your brain, I say, look, if I put you in the army and under this circumstances, you've got the brain of a hero in those contexts. But I take that same brain and I put you in this kind of context. I mean, you've got the brain of a serial killer, right? I mean, so can't we, you don't think we'll ever discover like the function from brain plus environment to behavioral outcome?
Here's the thing. Because brains are plastic, which means they are constantly changing and rewriting their own circuitry based on every experience, you don't even know what putting a brain into a context is going to do. In other words, you know, let's say you have three brains that are identical. 5 days from now, they won't even be identical anymore. They'll be sort of different. So there's the world is too complicated, and decision-making and choices and crime is too complicated and too context-dependent to ever be able to make a reasonable prediction. Let me just give you an example, which is every time there's a school shooter or a mass shooter, for example, what happened in Aurora, Colorado recently, you know, everyone tries to figure out, okay, what do these guys have in common? The Secret Service has been studying this for decades. And the answer is we can't conclude anything about them from a neural point of view. Why? Because it's so rare. It's such a rare behavior that we're not able to say anything about the brain of a serial killer or a mass murderer because there aren't enough of them and there's nothing clear that comes out of it. When we put together all the parameters we have, what we find is there are hundreds of thousands of kids who have those same parameters, and yet they don't go off and do that.
Let me call your attention to something. That granting everything you say, it's very hard to predict, even if we know a lot about the brains, a lot of things we're interested in, like violent behavior. On the other hand, it's kind of amazing. Look at the fact that we all showed up connected by phone lines within 5 minutes of each other this morning. Why did we do that? Well, because we were each predicting what the other one was going to do. So somehow, in spite of the complexity of the brain, common sense has given us a battery of concepts, belief, deliberations, the reasons a person has for doing something, that is tremendously powerful in a wide range of normal conditions. Does brain science have an explanation for how well common sense does with these kind of antediluvian cultural concepts that are left over from days when we thought the Earth was flat and all sorts of strange things?
The general story is this. We all make models of one another. I have an internal model of you guys, and I assumed that if we all promised to be on the phone at the same time, then we would be here. But the fact is, most of us have very limited models of other humans. We assume that all people are pretty much like us. And most of the time, that's correct. And it turns out that at the tails of the distribution, mm-hmm. it can be really incorrect, which is exactly why so many serial murderers live in communities where no one even suspects them at all. And it's because your brain doesn't even go there and thinking, oh, well, maybe my neighbor is killing people and putting their heads in his refrigerator.
Oh, my brain goes there all the time.
John's one sick
because
puppy.
We're actually quite poor at making models of other people. We're good enough to get by as a species. But I think what makes a really good detective is someone who has a broad model of human behavior. So when Scott Peterson comes to him and says, help, my pregnant wife is missing, a good detective thinks, oh, well, maybe you killed her. Whereas the rest of the nation doesn't even think that, and they feel so terrible for this guy.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about neuroscience and the law with David Eagleman. Karen from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Karen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering whether it makes a difference if we think about what the purpose of the law is. So whether we should think of the law as providing a punitive purpose or holding someone accountable, or whether we should see the law more in a consequentialist term in terms of that it should protect society from people who might harm others. In that case, it seems that whether someone is committing a crime because of deliberative decision-making or because of a tumor, we need to make sure that that person can't affect society in his nefarious ways. And therefore, maybe the law shouldn't be so much focused on notions of responsibility, but rather on consequentialist notions of what's best for society.
Excellent question, Karen. David, I bet you like that question.
I love that question. Thank you, Karen. There are different views of what the penal system should be about. I think that punitive versus protection, they don't actually have to be exclusive. In my opinion, protecting society from bad actors is the main reason for it. And it turns out that sometimes punishment is exactly what the doctor ordered. So, for example, I'm not opposed to incarceration because for many people, it's the original rewire your brain solution. It's punishing to them and they don't like it and they don't want to be back in prison and it serves as a deterrent for future crime. It's just that it doesn't work for everybody. So if somebody has defective systems in terms of deliberation and reward and punishment, let's say, for example, they're mentally ill, then putting them in jail doesn't accomplish anything. And same with people who, for example, are drug addicts. You can't punish them out of that. You need better rehabilitative strategies. So the key is, I think that protecting society is the main thing, but we can be so much more customized and tailor our sentencing and our rehabilitative strategies. As it stands now, there's very little effort being put into rehab. So as two examples, the estimates now are that 35% of our incarcerated population has mental illness. This is not the right place for us to be putting our mentally ill. Our prison system has become our de facto mental health care system. But there are so many more fruitful things we can be doing there while protecting society at the same time. And the other one, of course, is drug addicts. Our systems are stuffed with drug addicts. And we know so much at this point about the circuitry and pharmacology of drug addiction. And we can help people at a neural level. So instead of spending $40 billion on the war on drugs, where we try to attack the drug supply, which will never work, instead we should be addressing drug demand, which is the brain of the addict. So,
well, I totally agree with that. It's interesting to look at our current politics. You would think our biggest problem in the world, in America, is the deficit. But, you know, global warming, how about that? You know, having this tremendous percentage of our population in prison, how about that? Drugs that are destroying our southern neighbor, how about that? So I'm right with you. Let me just make a point, though, that I think brain science is great. I'm all for it. I'm a devotee of it. But a lot of what's wrong with our prison system seems pretty obvious without that. Over the weekend, there was a story that had everybody enthralled about some Middle East country where they cut off a man's hand for thievery. And years ago, there was a story in Singapore about caning some guy for chewing gum on the subway. And we think that's just horrible, corporal punishment. But we don't think a thing about taking 10 years of a person's life away from them for selling dope. So Americans just have a completely confused idea about what they're doing. The prison system was originally not supposed to be punishment. It was supposed to be an alternative to punishment where you could have people available for treatment and re-education. But now we have used it as this completely bonkers way of punishing people.
But both of you guys are skating over something quickly that I think deserves to be thought about. It seems to me that neither of you really believes in the concept of a just desert. Why do we punish it? Because the criminal deserves punishment. Why does the criminal deserve punishment? Because he did what he did or she did what she did freely of her own volition. And so it's a kind of response to the ill will that the criminal exhibited in acting that we punish them not for, you know, rehabilitation, but because of just desert. Neither of you seem to believe in the concept of just desert.
Well, I certainly don't believe in the concept of just desert that some philosophers believe in that comes out of Christianity, which is that somehow somebody's done something so they deserve everlasting punishment in hell. And if that's the criterion, then no, I don't believe in it. I do believe in not deserving punishment, like if you didn't do it or you did it as a result of a ping pong in your head.
What do you think, David?
You know, there are two ways the justice system can look, backwards or forwards. Backward looking is you deserve it and we're going to punish you for what has happened. A forward-looking system says, look, what do we do moving forward? What is the probability that you are going to recidivate, that you will reoffend, things like that? The reason brain science complexifies the just desserts position is, take for example the sudden pedophile that you guys covered at the beginning of the show. So he made an inappropriate move on his prepubescent stepdaughter, but it turned out he had a massive frontal lobe tumor, and when that was removed, his sexual behavior went exactly back to normal. This illustrates this very deep point, which is that changes in your brain cause changes in your behavior. And I think this is where the question of just desserts immediately gets more complicated, because what do you do with somebody like that?
Well, that's a deep question, and we're going to ponder it some more after a break. It's Philosophy Talk. We're talking about neuroscience and the law with David Eagleman from the Baylor College of Medicine, who's author of also The Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain.
In our next segment, we're going to look into whether the justice system ought to be reformed in the light of new discoveries in neurosciences, and if so, how.
Rewriting the law, rewiring the brain, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Insane in the membrane, or just an imbalance in the brain. This is Philosophy Talk, and we're talking about neuroscience and the law. I'm John Perry.
I'm Ken Taylor, and our guest is David Eagleman from the Baylor College of Medicine. We've got a caller on the line, Vera from New Orleans. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Vera.
Hello.
All the way from New Orleans.
Comment.
That's cool.
I practice criminal law in New Orleans, and in my experience, I estimate that about 40% of crimes are committed while the perpetrators are in an altered state by alcohol, prescription drugs, or illegal drugs. So if we're talking about neuroscience, don't we have to consider the altered brain as well as the brain that's not chemically altered?
Good question, Jared. So, David, what do you want to make of that question? Lots of issues.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. We have to consider the brain at the time, but also what we have to consider is what is really the fundamental question. What is the likelihood of recidivism? So if you have someone who acts in a criminal manner when he's on these drugs and he's likely to continue taking these drugs, you have to protect society from him. And hopefully there's a rehabilitative strategy that can be taken, but in any case, you have to take him off the street. So in other words, a point that's so important here is that as we understand better and better how people behave and why they behave, it doesn't let anyone off the hook. It just says, what can we say about their future behavior, given everything we can study and the ways that we can help them.
So do I have a responsibility, I mean, to maintain my brain at its neurological normal state to the extent that I can? I know that if I take alcohol or drink or drugs and I drive or, you know, so I have that much control over my brain chemistry. I can keep myself out of a drunken state when I'm about to get in a car. Isn't that something that's up to me?
Well, again, it's your cost-benefit equation, but it is something that you're legally responsible for. Here's an example. If you crash your car because you had an epileptic seizure, you are not responsible if that was your first seizure. On the other hand, if you know that you have epilepsy and that you're prone to that and you didn't take your meds, then you are responsible.
So David, that sounds like something that we've got in the law that makes a lot of sense. So let's make you king for a day, with absolute power to change whatever you want about our criminal justice system. You don't have time to do the whole thing, but you've got a couple of things you can do. As a neuroscientist, what would your top one or two priorities be for your day in absolute power?
That's easy. The first thing is implementing customized sentencing. So the way it works now is in many jurisdictions, there are these mandatory sentences that have to be imposed, and it doesn't make sense because you can have very different brains in front of the judge's bench who got there for different reasons. So you have customized sentencing that's evidence-based. It's based on the science in terms of probability of future recidivism. Hand in hand with that is real, meaningful rehabilitation, methods for rehabilitation, so that instead of locking a body away in prison for decades, you can try to help the person eventually reintegrate into society. And I will say there is a sense in which we're already moving in the right direction. Many jurisdictions now are moving towards specialized court systems where they peel off from the main court system a drug court, a juvenile court, a mental health court. And this is a really promising step in terms of customization because there you have judges and lawyers with expertise in those issues.
Let me take you a step back, because that's a powerful suggestion. Customized sentencing, sort of tailored to the brain chemistry, as it were, of the person who did that. But I'm wondering how that connects up with other things you said. You said, you know, given a brain, we have no idea what's it going to do because it depends so much on the environment. There's so many variables. I mean, so given a brain that did something, how are we going to really be able to find the thing in the brain that's responsible for their doing this? Because it sounded like you thought it's a combination of brain plus environment. So how can we ever isolate the thing in the brain that made them do the thing? I thought your first thing, do it prospectively, how can we do it retrospectively?
So let me give you a perfect analogy here, which is if you're running a life insurance company, you make actuarial tables and you say, okay, look, you're this old, you're a smoker, this, that, the other, and you make these probability tables. And that does not mean that you know exactly the day that this guy is going to die or exactly of what. Nonetheless, you have a lot of data that points you in the right direction of whether this guy is a high risk or a low risk or somewhere in between. And that's exactly what's happening in the last decade as people collect real numbers, tens of thousands of people after they're released from prison. You follow them out for a decade. You see who recidivates and who does not. And you can figure out, given all the factors that we can measure, what seems to make somebody really high risk or somebody really low risk. And then you can base sentencing on that. And that's already being used in pre-sentencing decisions, because it just is the case that people's brains are very different across almost any axis that you want to measure. And some people are more dangerous than others. And we can reflect that in our sentencing. I'll give you an example of how it's already built into our intuition. When somebody is on trial for having killed a spouse that he or she caught with a lover, we treat that crime of passion differently than we do, let's say, a premeditated murder. Why? Because their future behavior is probably going to be different. I mean, a premeditated murderer is more likely to keep going out and doing that stuff, whereas the person who was heartbroken when they caught their spouse is less likely to display that future behavior. That's why we treat their sentencing differently.
So we've got an interesting email here from Elwood in Bangor, Maine. He says, you guys have talked a lot about blame, but we also give credit in common sense. Now, suppose that a guy won a Congressional Medal of Honor for heroic bravery of a completely unusual sort, and then it was discovered that actually he had a ping pong ball-sized tumor in his brain that was pushing on the part of the brain that usually makes us a little more circumspect. Would we take away his Congressional Medal of Honor because we say, oh, he didn't really deserve it because what he did was due to the tumor and not to normal functioning brain chemistry?
I think that's a lovely point. The fact is that we all tend to take credit for our really good decisions, and then for our bad decisions, we maybe blame our history or our genes or things like that. But the fact is, we are inseparable from this 3 pounds of wet, gushy stuff in our skull. And what's obvious from the last several hundred years is that when there are even small changes in the brain, that changes our behavior. And I think,
is that kind of example at all realistic? Are there any examples of, lesions or alterations in the brain chemistry that push people toward the good rather than toward, doing dysfunctional things?
Well, I mean, in general, there can be real changes in your impulse control. So anybody who gets damage to their frontal lobes, the part behind your forehead, they get worse at sort of long-term deliberative thinking, and they become slave to their impulses. So, for example, patients with frontotemporal dementia will start doing whatever they want to. They'll take off their clothes in public.
I know that kind of thing. I'm wondering about the other kind of thing.
So what I'm saying is, a lot of times acts of heroism are also a matter of not doing a lot of long-term deliberative thinking and then just, jumping in and doing the right thing. So it wouldn't be at all surprising for brain damage to lead to somebody not getting stuck in deliberation and doing the right thing. The answer is I don't think we have any good examples because the number of examples we have of good or bad behavior being caused by, let's say, a brain tumor – These are very few in number right now, but they won't be in 10 years. Why? Because brain imaging technology is really on the scene now,
right?
And we're going to find more and more examples of this sort of thing.
Well, I thought you were going to say something else, because it seems to me there's a great limitation to neuroscience, and it's these human subjects committees in universities, right? If you could toy with people's brains, if you put a lesion here and put a lesion there, take this population and you have to kind of take what you find. Isn't that a limitation of, you can't really break the brain and see how it works. You have to take them as they come, some broken, some not broken.
Well, that's true, but it turns out that Mother Nature is such a prolific experimenter that we find brain lesions of every sort every day. So there's plenty, tragically, there's plenty of data out there about different types of damage to the brain.
Well, I suppose that's a good thing, because at least you don't have to generate the data. So look, again, the concept of dessert, responsibility, all those things, I just kind of want your final take. Are those concepts, do you think those concepts, which are based on philosophy, religion, and common sense, right, the concept of a self that's in control of its, are those concepts just neuroscientifically bankrupt? Is that your final thought, that we just need a whole kit of new concepts, which would be good for me as a philosopher because, I'm in the business of thinking up concepts?
The answer is yes. The idea that there's the reasonable man standard and we all act of our free will, the legal system calls this practical reasoners, that we just get to make our own choices, and the idea that all brains are created equal, which is baked into the legal system, these are all ideas that aren't really in alignment with modern neuroscience. We find that along any axis we measure brains, they're very different from one another.
So let me ask you another question about this, though. Let me ask you another question. Those are all what people think of as common sense psychological concepts. Maybe they're not the right psychological concepts. Maybe they need some refining. But do you want to just talk about the chemistry and neural anatomy of the brain, or are there any sort of higher level psychological software level concepts that you think apply and help us understand?
I mean, the software level concept way of thinking about it is what we touched on earlier, which is, what is this guy's cost-benefit equation in his head? Sometimes we can connect that all the way down to the neurobiology. Often we can't. So if we're just talking on a software level, then we would say, look, what does this guy's previous behavior tell us about what he's likely to do in the future? The place where the neurobiology comes important is when we can have some sort of meaningful rehabilitation and integrate somebody back into pro-social behavior.
Well, extending the computer analogy a little bit, years ago when PCs were first coming out, I had a brother, he's since died, but he was a computer programmer at IBM. And he sent me this big book on programming in assembly language, and he said, John, you'll love this because, you know, if you just program in Fortran or Lisp or something like that, you're so limited. But once you get down to assembly language, you can do anything you want. Well, I must admit, I did not find it all that satisfactory. For most of us, dealing with your computer at the level of bytes and bits or anywhere close to it is impossible. And I suspect the same is true with humans. We'll have to continue using our concepts of belief, deliberation, the person's reasons. Then, when we find these cases over, as you say, in the extreme parts of the bell curve, it'll be like when I spill coffee on my computer. You can't program your way out of that. You got to take it to someone who can take it apart and put it back together.
Well, David, your last thought on what John just said there, because that's a big issue.
That's a big issue. I'll say briefly what my thought is, which is that all of this exists on a spectrum. So as it stands right now, we can find a tumor. We can find some really big problem in someone's brain. And then we say, oh, you poor guy, it wasn't really your fault. But if it's, let's say, the common criminal in the prison system, first of all, we don't bother doing an MRI on him. But even if we did, we might not be able to see anything because there's a lot buried in the microcircuitry that we can't read out yet. And so we say, that's completely your fault and you deserve punishment for it. But the fact is, these guys represent ends of a spectrum, and as our technology moves forward over the coming decades, then more and more people who were on the blameworthy side of the line are going to shift over to the, oh, now we understand you have such and such syndrome side of the line. And it can't be a just system to say that you are blameworthy or not based on our current line of technology. And so what this conundrum gets us into is the idea that maybe culpability isn't the right question to be asking. Maybe blameworthiness isn't the right question, but instead the question is, what do we do moving forward?
On that question, I want to thank you for joining. It's been an electrifying conversation.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our guest has been David Eagleman. He's director of the Initiative on Neuroscience and the Law at the Baylor College of Medicine, author of Incognito, The Secret Lives of Brain. This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You can also follow our tweets on Twitter and find out more from our Facebook page.
But wait, there's more. You can also sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website. That's philosophytalk.org. Now we peer into the speed-obsessed mind of Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, crime shows would be nowhere without rare and bizarre psychological and neurological disorders. Sufferers of pseudocyesis are fairly common in Lifetime movies. I saw an episode of Criminal Minds that centered around the Capgras delusion. And stories are constantly driven by serial killers, of course, which many argue we didn't even have a name for until the 1970s. Crime shows when I was a kid would have been nowhere without Freud. Remember Jimmy Cagney's Mommy Issues and White Heat? Remember the end of Psycho, when the shrink explains what exactly is wrong with poor Norman Bates? No, nowadays we wouldn't even bother. Just give Norman some Zoloft, a sex change, and shove her into solitary. We have disorders and syndromes up the wazoo. More mysteriously, on some cognitive level, how do we all even know what a wazoo is? Yet we do. We do seemingly anti-conscious behaviors every day. Yelling at the television, drinking too much, playing the lottery. Not long ago, presidential candidate Mitt Romney did something that puzzled me from a neuroscience point of view, assuming I have one. In a now-famous interview with NBC's Brian Williams, in which Romney alienated most of England, he was asked about dressage. Romney's wife Anne is part owner of a dressage horse named Rafalka and was competing in the Olympics. And I must ask, why are dancing horses allowed in the Olympics and not, say, frisbee-catching dogs? Anyway, dressage. Mitt Romney told Brian Williams, quote, I have to tell you, this is Anne's sport. I'm not even sure which day the sport goes on. She will get the chance to see it. I will not be watching the event. I hope her horse does well, unquote. Can someone tell me what was going on in his mind when he said that? He's going to be in England when the Olympics are happening. His wife is a very valuable animal competing in the Olympics. He doesn't know when the event is taking place and doesn't plan to attend. I mean, if I were as rich as him, and it could happen if my numbers ever come in, one of the first things I'd buy would be a dancing horse, and I'd brag about it. Then I'd fire everybody in America and light my Cuban cigar with a $100 bill. If you have a dancing horse, in other words, why poo-poo the idea of dancing horses? Especially since, as it turned out, Mitt Romney did attend the dressage event, sitting with the VIPs and cheering Rafalka on. Double what the hell. So does Mitt Romney suffer from denial, from confabulation or a tame version of the Anton Babinski syndrome? Does he just not want to be perceived as horsey? Does he believe that having a dancing horse is no different than owning a goldfish? And why isn't a border collie herding sheep at an Olympic event? Call me delusional, but I think that's a million-dollar idea. I gotta go.
The Wisdom of the Ages, in a nutshell, from Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2012.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. The director of research is Laura McGuire.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, Jimmy Tobin, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation and from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.